You're listening to The Lost Cause, a special project from Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. In the end, the Confederacy was crushed in bloody battle. For all of his vaunted military stature, the Confederate General-in-Chief Robert E. Lee fell short. In April 1865, on behalf of the rebellion, Lee surrendered at Appomattox, Virginia. The victor was General Ulysses S. Grant, who had successfully commanded the U.S. Army and would shortly be elected 18th President of the United States. But the values championed by the Confederacy would survive as the lost cause. Historian Hillary Green.
So it's all about symbol making. It's all about myth making and assuaging that guilt, that loss, that defeat, and instituting back a white supremacist world where African Americans, though freed, are now still the racial inferiors of white Americans.
What exactly was the guilt? What did they feel guilty for?
The guilt is that they committed themselves to a nation that lost, and it's a failed nation state. Then you have to apologize and declare your allegiance back to join back the nation that you left.
Namely, the United States of America.
Yes. So you were wrong in what you did. You defied, and as some in the North would say, and also federal government, you committed treason against the United States of America. And then you had to come back to that nation.
After Civil War hostilities ended, Confederate states were required to guarantee the right to vote to African American men who were formerly held as slaves. But for many white Southerners, it was a devastating humiliation.
To understand the violence that was to come fairly quickly, whether it's the Ku Klux Klan or it's many other organized imitators or just individualized violence in the South, you've got to try to grasp it in that situation.
David Blight at Yale University is an historian of the Civil War and Reconstruction. His biography, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, won the Pulitzer Prize.
The South was in desperate straits. It's economically crushed. There are whole regions of the South that are essentially destroyed.
The whole slave trade is abolished.
The domestic slave trade is now dead. The property held in slaves by Southerners, ownership of people, that just financial asset, let's call it what it was, is now gone. The federal government, through military force and an executive order known as the Emancipation Proclamation, had confiscated that property. There has never been, and probably never will be again, a confiscation of private property as large as that. Thousands upon thousands of white Southerners who survived as soldiers are trekking home on foot in most cases. Some, if they had a horse, I guess cavalrymen were allowed to keep their horses, to devastated farms, to families that had lost brothers, husbands. And the victorious side, the North, the federal government, the Union, as it became known in the war, now it faces this challenge of what can Reconstruction mean?
When the Union prevailed, it meant that at great cost to life and limb and treasure, the United States of America, a bold yet flawed experiment in democracy, had survived.
What do you do in a republic if you've had a massive all-out civil war caused by this system of racial slavery? You have destroyed that system of racial slavery, but who are now the former slaves? What are they? What will the freedmen become? What kind of new constitution will you craft for this new republic, this second republic? And they absolutely had a vision that they were creating something new.
Through the constitutional amendments enacted shortly after the Civil War ended in 1865, the structure of the United States underwent fundamental change. It was the era called Reconstruction. Slavery was finally wiped out, and African American men were permitted to vote. Women of all races would have to wait another half century. And unlike today, the Republicans were regarded as the liberal party. Manisha Sinha's author of The Rise and Fall of the Second American Republic.
With the Reconstruction Acts, you had new state constitutions being written in the South, in which black people participated under a lot of, you know, debate and duress, but they participated. And you had new state governments put into place. This meant that you had the Republican Party spreading all over the South, which was mainly composed of African Americans and Southern white unionists and Northern Republicans. They come together, they establish local state governments, they send congressmen and senators to the federal government. So you have black political representation at all levels. Thousands of black local and state office holders are elected at this point.
On the ground in the South, these were extraordinarily radical ideas. This meant, as somebody famously said, you know, the bottom rail is going to be on top now. They're slaves yesterday, tomorrow they're going to be elected to office and they're going to run things. Well, that was not entirely untrue.
The last shall be first.
The last shall be first. But what you've got is this unprecedented, raw situation of terrible hatreds. That's what it was.
Racism had been firmly entrenched in plantation culture and the profitable business of slavery. It would not be easily dislodged. But at first, Reconstruction did usher in a period of greater legal protection for the newly freed people.
Well, it had been implemented for a short while. When the will was there, when the Republican Party was the party of Lincoln, anti-slavery and black rights, the federal government did implement most of these laws and amendments. They even passed enforcement acts to prevent domestic racist terrorism in the South. Groups such as the Ku Klux Klan, the White League, the White Liners, the Red Shirts. Unfortunately, by around the middle of the 1870s, the second term of Grant's office, there's a lot of opposition to this experiment in black citizenship.
And that backlash directly threatened the hard-won gains achieved during Reconstruction. An activist faction of the party, known as the Radical Republicans, saw African-American rights slipping away.
The Republican Party goes from being the party of anti-slavery to the party of big business during the Gilded Age. It's the takeoff of industrial capitalism in the North. Many Northerners, Northern elites, are sympathetic to Southern elites who are complaining about labor. So you have a backing away from a commitment to upholding black rights by the federal government, by much of the Republican Party, and you have a very reactionary Supreme Court that misinterprets and completely undoes many of these significant federal civil rights laws and also constitutional amendments.
What was the motive of those Supreme Court justices to undo some of these rights that had been guaranteed in the amendments to the Constitution?
Well, you know, the Supreme Court at that time consisted of justices who were appointed by Republican and Democratic presidents. You would think that the ones appointed by the Republican presidents would have been more sympathetic to Reconstruction, but that is not the case. Most of the judges of the Supreme Court at that time were mediocrities. Many of them were railroad lawyers. And they were very sympathetic to the argument that government, especially the federal government, should not interfere in state affairs.
It was at this time that the pendulum of American history began to swing back. As has so often happened in the United States, and as is visible today, the forces of reaction were bolstered by our federal courts.
In the civil rights cases, they overturned the 1875 Civil Rights Act that had been written into law by Charles Sumner, the great abolitionist senator from Massachusetts. that actually made Jim Crow illegal before it was established in the South, and specified huge penalties for those who would institute racial segregation, whether they were private railroad cars or theaters, any place, public place. And the Supreme Court said that is unconstitutional. So they overturned the 1875 civil rights law, greenlighting Jim Crow, of course, ending with Plessy versus Ferguson.
That was the landmark decision in 1896, establishing the legal doctrine of separate but equal. The court ruled it was permissible to impose laws that kept people of different races apart, a system of American apartheid favored by the proponents of the Lost Cause. Historian Hillary Green.
In the 1890s, you have the United Daughters of the Confederacy get formed, and that's where you really see it as a unified commemorative tradition with very little dissent over what does it mean to say the Lost Cause and what the war is about. The 1870s and 80s becomes that way where they're defining it and getting consensus.
So you're saying it actually took a couple of decades for this myth to harden?
Yes, because you always had your ones early on who were firmly committed. As people started dying off, the next generation are hearing these stories. And it goes through the early monuments building that women are doing in cemeteries. But it also is a reaction to what Reconstruction's and what's happening during Reconstruction, too. You can't divorce the hardening of the Lost Cause without talking about lynching, disenfranchisement, and other things going on during the overturn of Reconstruction.
Adherents of the Lost Cause never acknowledged that the U.S. Army, the Union, legitimately won the Civil War. Instead, they honored the slave states' rebellion, erecting hundreds of statues and monuments glorifying Confederate officers, even naming major U.S. military bases for what they called Southern heroes. Some of this was reversed under President Biden, but those efforts faced new roadblocks in the Trump administration. We're exploring the bitter legacy of racial division left over from the Civil War, how it's still affecting American life today. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. For more information on the segment, The Lost Cause, and to obtain audio downloads or CDs, please visit humanmedia.org. The Southern Rebellion began with the refusal to accept Lincoln's first election, the event that triggered slave states to withdraw from the United States of America. There are parallels today in the election denialism we've seen since Joe Biden defeated then-President Donald Trump in 2020. Here's Trump's statement after Election Day.
This is a fraud on the American public. This is an embarrassment to our country. We were getting ready to win this election. Frankly, we did win this election.
And that's, I think, is one of the interesting things in how this wave of denialism is continuing. And where are they finding their foundation? They're finding it in the Lost Cause. And they're finding it in the ways to overturn it. So I think for us to understand today's movement, we really need to go to how the Lost Cause got developed and how it hardened over time. Because one of the most chilling images that I saw on January 6th was a gentleman holding a Confederate flag. You can't get around that symbol, but that symbol is so much the Lost Cause.
How did you personally react on seeing the Confederate flags that were brought into the U.S. Capitol by participants in the January 6th riot in 2021?
It was a complete revulsion for a long time.
When he worked for the U.S. Department of Justice, former Senator Doug Jones successfully prosecuted members of the Klan. In 1963, they had planted a bomb that killed four young girls attending an historically black church in Birmingham, Alabama. Almost 40 years later, two of the participants were finally convicted. Jones takes particular exception to the Confederate flag.
That bombing happened right 5 days after Birmingham City schools were desegregated, and there were boycotts going on all across the city of Birmingham in 1963. And the kids in all of those schools were boycotting and coming out on the grounds, and they were waving Confederate battle flags. Those weren't symbols of history. Those were symbols of hate. And to watch what happened on January 6th, I was just completely revulsed at everything that I saw going on, but particularly seeing Confederate battle flags roaming through the halls of the United States Capitol, when in fact it had been just about a month earlier when the statue of Robert E. Lee was removed from the Capitol because of his history.
Had Confederate battle flags ever before been paraded through the Capitol?
I can't think of any time in our history since the Civil War where there was some open display of Confederate battle flags at that time. And it wasn't just January 6th. These white nationalists, I mean, this had been building. You had seen it in Charlottesville.
In August 2017, white supremacists gathered for a rally called Unite the Right, held in Charlottesville, Virginia. A supporter deliberately drove his car into a crowd protesting the rally, killing a young woman and injuring 35. Confederate and Nazi flags were openly displayed.
We have had times in our history in this country, at least in the last 100 years, in which there were kind of movements along those lines. For instance, it was in the 30s, before World War II, where there was a growing movement of fascism in this country. Charles Lindbergh was one of a leading kind of proponents about that. And there were rallies in which you saw American flags and Nazi flags side by side.
But you also had people that were very fine people on both sides. You had people in that group, excuse me, I saw the same pictures as you did. You had people in that group that were there to protest the taking down of, to them, a very, very important statue and the renaming of a park from Robert E. Lee to another name.
In some ways, the continuing struggle for greater equality and inclusiveness has been the storyline of America. It drove the most violent chapter of that story, the U.S. Civil War. Daniel Day-Lewis won the Oscar for Best Actor as the title character in Steven Spielberg's Lincoln.
We're stepped out upon the world stage now. Now! With the fate of human dignity in our hands. Blood's been spilt to afford us this moment. Now, now, now. Abolishing slavery by constitutional provision settles the fate for all coming time. Not only of the millions now in bondage, but of unborn millions to come.
President Abraham Lincoln was assassinated 5 days after the Confederacy surrendered to the U.S. Army in April 1865. And while slavery was abolished that year by constitutional amendment, racial tensions in America have simmered ever since.
It's the anxiety of white elites in society and those who are feeling for every African-American gain, there has to be a loss to whiteness.
Historian Hillary Green of Davidson College.
And you see this after the Civil War from those early proponents of the Lost Cause and the violence that they're willing to enact against African Americans because that success should not occur.
The early years of Reconstruction meant new civil rights for the formerly enslaved people. But strident backlash and the adoption of Jim Crow segregation in the South would shortly erode many of those freedoms. And in recent years, accurately presenting this history in schools through textbooks has come under attack. Opponents object to a suggestion that all white people will be branded as oppressors.
Textbooks tell a simplified narrative and easy, but the textbooks that a lot of these anti-textbooks individuals want to go back to is a period that did not include accurate histories of African Americans in them. It included Lost Cause portrayals of Gone with the Wind as the norm. But now, after the Civil Rights Movement, actually included more truthful and accurate histories that includes America in all its fullest, but also not just a top-down, a heroic, great man, American exceptionalist narrative, but one that honestly talks about the contributions of women, indigenous people, African Americans to the nation, including slavery, and then its aftermath.
Progress on racial equality has advanced only slowly in fits and starts, and often over strenuous objection.
In the 1940s, Harry Truman desegregated the U.S. military. It was the 1940s that happened, 80 years after the Civil War. So I think that the movement had started and was building, and this was an effort to make sure that there were roadblocks put up wherever they could do it. And you do that by recognizing and supporting those who protected the institutions of not just the lost cause in the Confederacy, but the institutions that kept black people down in this country and kept them, as folks would often say, in their place. And that was the real challenge. The Confederate battle flag did not really take hold until into the 20th century as the civil rights movement began to grow.
As a kind of defiance of that civil rights movement?
Absolutely. There is no question about that.
Popular culture, which became more sophisticated in this period, played an influential role in reinforcing the lost cause. Birth of a Nation, originally titled The Klansman, was a silent film released in 1915, running more than 2 hours. President Woodrow Wilson, a Lost Cause sympathizer, screened the movie at the White House. The Hollywood blockbuster Gone with the Wind, starring Clark Gable and Vivian Leigh, romanticized the Confederacy. It was based on Margaret Mitchell's 1936 novel set in Georgia during the Civil War. The movie came out in 1939. In today's dollars, it's the highest grossing film ever.
This sure is a happy day to me. I done died for 3 generations of this family's girl, and it sure is a happy day.
Oh, yes, Mammy, the happiest days are when babies come. I wish... Oh, Mammy, she's beautiful. What do you suppose they'll name her?
Miss Scarlett done told me if it was a girl, she's going to name it Eugenia Victoria.
Could you address this specific image of the happy slave, which clearly is depicted in Gone with the Wind?
Yes, and this is why the Lost Cause is that slavery was the natural state of African Americans, and that they could not conceive of a world without abandoned love for their white enslavers. And that happiness and also their sadness when slavery's no more, that's why you have the mammy figure crying and trying to remain in that condition. And ignores that African Americans pursued freedom. And also it's easy to then portray African Americans as childlike, unable to live in society, and that slavery was a happy condition for them. And without slavery, they were miserable. They had a hard time living. And again, none of that's true, but it's easy to live out this fantasy.
Red, where are you going?
I'm going, my dear, to join the army.
Oh, you're joking. I could kill you for scaring me so.
I'm very serious, Scarlett. I'm going to join up with our brave lads in gray.
But they're running away.
Oh, no. They'll turn and make a last stand if I know anything about them. And when they do, I'll be with them. I'm a little late, but better late.
Red, you must be joking.
Selfish to the end, aren't you? Thinking only of your own precious hide with never a thought for the noble cause.
Red, how could you do this to me? And why should you go now that after it's all over and I need you? Why? Why?
Why? Maybe it's because I've always had a weakness for lost causes once they're really lost. Or maybe...
Maybe I'm ashamed of myself.
In its day, Gone with the Wind was phenomenally successful. Nearly half the U.S. population bought tickets to see it. It was also widely screened across Europe. But Margaret Mitchell's novel perpetuated stereotypes, some of which do not withstand scrutiny.
Mammy and Prissy stay with the family after the Emancipation Proclamation throughout Reconstruction, even though they can't pay them because they're so loyal. This idea of the loyal slave. So that's another part that's in there. The KKK is there to protect the women. So as she says in the book, that the KKK is to stop black people from voting 8 to 10 times and to protect white women. Remember, the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan, is a white terror organization meant to cow black people into not voting and to ensure they stay in debt peonage.
One other note on Gone with the Wind. Its leading black character, an enslaved maid called Mammy, was played in the film by Hattie McDaniel. For her performance, she became, at age 44, the first African-American ever to win an Oscar. But at the banquet, the hotel where it was held prohibited McDaniel from sitting at the same table as the movie's white cast members. The agonizingly long practice of prejudice in our history has left virtually no part of American life untouched. So it remains for leaders today to move the United States toward a more perfect union. Again, former Senator Doug Jones.
First of all, people have to have the courage to stand up and speak out, as my friend the late John Lewis used to say, and do so sometimes at the cost of their own political fortunes. Right now, people, there are too many enablers that do not want to stand up and speak out because they are know that they are likely to be able to get those votes. So I think that that is number one. And I really believe, too, that the faith community and the business community play huge roles in that, that should be demanding that more and more these days.
You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Antonio Oliart-Rose. Editorial assistance from Kathy Graham, Ken Rogers, and Rowan Edwards. Webmaster Brian K. Johnson. Special thanks to Laura Carlo, Graham Espy, Josh Sacco, Robert Frazier, and the Music Division of the Library of Congress. Thanks also to Steve Martin, Jack Klapisch, and Tony Buck. Program is presented by Human Media.
To download an audio copy of this program and access other resources, please visit humanmedia.org. That's humanmedia.org. You can also access our other programs and send us an email from our website. Again, our web address is humanmedia.org.
And you can subscribe to our free weekly podcast, Humankind on Public Radio. This segment, The Lost Cause, is Humankind Program number 294.
The executive producer is David Freudberg. This is Humankind.